This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. On the 29th of August 1949 at 7 a.m, the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb. The test surprised the Western powers. American intelligence had estimated that the Soviets would not produce an atomic weapon until 1953, while Britain didn't expect it until 1954. The speed at which the Soviet Union developed their bomb was due to a network of spies from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada, who gave the Soviet Union the necessary information to develop an atomic bomb. They were motivated by a range of factors. Some, such as ideology or a belief in communism, were committed to advancing the interests of the Soviet Union. Others were motivated by financial gain, while some may have been coerced or blackmailed into spying. I speak with author Andrew Long, who's written Secrets of the Cold War, Espionage and Intelligence Operations from Both Sides of the Iron Curtain, which covers this story and many others. I'm delighted to welcome Andrew Long to our Cold War conversation.
This all revolves around the study of the atom, atomic physics. And the best minds in this field, it was quite a narrow field back in the late 1930s, was concentrated around universities in the US, universities in the UK, and various European capitals. And these were really the sort of hot cells of knowledge and discovery. It came to a bit of a head in 1938. So this is obviously before the breakout of the Second World War, when some scientists in Germany managed to split the atom. And what they found was that there was a release of energy at the moment the atom split. Now, this was a completely new phenomenon. It took them a little while to actually get their heads around what exactly was happening. So a few years later, the dark clouds of war fall over Europe, and these scientists, again, in these various different hotspots around the world, start to realise that there could be a military application for this, this new scientific phenomenon. In the UK, it was centred around various universities, and a couple of scientists started to theorise that in certain circumstances, a huge amount of energy could be released in the form of an explosion. And that explosion could potentially be part of a bomb. Now, the guy was called Otto Frisch. He was a Jewish refugee, fled from the Nazis. And he teamed up with a guy called Rudolf Peierls, again, another Jewish refugee. And they put together a proposal, if you like, a memorandum, which became known as the Frisch-Peierls memorandum, quite a famous document, that conceptualized what was in effect the atomic bomb. It's quite a chilling document written in 1940, considering what was to come a few years down the line. Anyway, this memo found its way onto Churchill's desk, Winston Churchill, British Prime Minister. He thought, okay, we need to get this looked into, because they were of the opinion that if the British scientific community could come up with the idea, then possibly the German scientific community could come up with the same idea, which actually what was happening. So Churchill gave the go-ahead for an exploratory committee, which was set up. It was called the Maud Committee, M-A-U-D. Now, for quite a while, people tried to guess what Maud stood for. So was it some strange acronym to do with uranium or something like that? Well, actually, it was a much more simplistic answer. It was a random word chosen from a telegram. Actually, Maud referred to a lady called Maud Ray, who was a governess of one of the physicists' children. So it was just a name plucked out of a random document. But, okay, it became the Maud Committee. And this pulled together all the different strands of the research in the UK, the physicists, the industrialists, chemists, and the started to bring together the whole thing into a project. A short while later, it was christened the Tube Alloys Project, which again was a cover name. And this, you know, started to get some momentum going. Over in the US, again, a similar group of physicists came up with a similar conclusion. The science was out there, they just had to think it through. And a guy called Leo Szilard, he was a physicist based over there, again, another refugee from Europe. He pulled in probably the father of atomic physics, Albert Einstein, and they put together a letter to President Roosevelt saying, listen, we've come up with this idea, therefore it's quite probable the British have, and also the Germans. So therefore it's in our interests to start to work on this because, you know, we want to be prepared. So they wrote a famous letter, became known as the Einstein-Szilard letter. That landed on Roosevelt's desk, and he gave the go-ahead for a project to look into this. Now, the UK project plateaued quite quickly. The science was there, but the UK basically didn't have the resources to industrialise, to make this science, this theory, into a practical device. So they reached out to the Americans. The Americans realised that they needed some of the British science. They had their own scientists, but the British had some useful things to bring to the party. So they joined forces, and it became, after various iterations, the Manhattan Project. It was the Manhattan Engineer District, but everyone referred to it as the Manhattan Project. Now, all this science, hundreds of physicists, probably the best physicists in the world, massive industrial concerns, hundreds of thousands of people all working, all culminating in a device that was tested in the desert in New Mexico on the 16th of July 1945 in what was called the Trinity test, and they detonated this device called the Gadget in the desert, and it worked. It created a massive atomic explosion. Basically, the cat was out of the bag now, that the world changed in a millisecond when the sky lit up with this fireball that was as hot as the centre of the sun. But of course, it was all under an overall blanket of security, or so they thought. Now, the practical application of this was a weapons deliverable bomb. And that was put to test only a few weeks later. Over Japan. So the war in Europe, the war against the Nazis, finished in May 1945, and the bomb, which wasn't ready anyway, but didn't have to be used to cause the collapse of Hitler's Nazi regime. However, the Japanese were fighting on, and so it was decided to use this wonder new weapon to try and bring the Pacific, the war against the Japanese, to a close. So on the 6th of August 1945, the weapon was tested, or the weapon was deployed over Hiroshima, the world's first atomic attack. And as we know, the city of Hiroshima was almost wiped off the face of the earth. A few days later, same with Nagasaki. That finally brought the Japanese to a surrender, and the war was over. And that was a terrible thing to bring about the conclusion of a long, bloody war. Now, that left the US in possession of this fantastic new technology. President Truman was told that it would probably give them something like a 10-year monopoly on the technology. And he was jealously protecting that technology because he wanted to obviously be the most powerful nation on the block. So they were enjoying that position when on the 29th of August 1949, a detonation was detected over the Soviet Union. It was a massive explosion in the Kazakhstan area, and after a few weeks of testing, sending out aeroplanes to try and sample the air, the Americans realized that the Soviets had exploded an atomic bomb. Shocked them to the core, because how on earth did they get hold of this technology, because it was top secret and nobody else knew about it.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. As you said there, the Americans are fundamentally, and the West is fundamentally, shocked that the Soviet Union has managed to develop this technology so quickly. But they have been aided in various nefarious ways, haven't they?
Well, that's right. How on earth did they get this technology? If you think about the state of the Soviet Union after the Second World War, it was ravaged by almost unbelievable degrees of destruction, millions killed, their industrial infrastructure was savaged, and the whole nation, or the sort of group of nations that came together to form the Soviet Union, had been totally focused on winning the war over the Germans. So how on earth did they do this? Well, the answer is very simple: espionage. To understand how this happened, we need to sort of like look back a few years. In the 1930s, Stalin realized that his great communist experiment was not giving him the cutting edge industry and technology he needed. It was dominated by a very inefficient, heavy industry and was lagging behind the rest of the developed world. So the only way that he could propel his huge country forward was to steal the knowledge and technology from his international rivals. And that's exactly what he did. He tasked his intelligence agencies, which was the NKVD. Now, just a quick pause here, because Stalin kept changing the name of his intelligence agencies, which gets mighty confusing. Ultimately, it became the KGB, as most people know. But there was probably like half a dozen different iterations of this over the years. So I'll use the word NKVD primarily to talk about the Soviet intelligence agencies. The KGB didn't actually come about until the 1950s. But there's also the GRU, which is the military intelligence arm. Anyway, he tasked his agencies to infiltrate all aspects of Western society and steal state, military, political, industrial secrets, all with the goal of furthering the communist system. So during the 30s, with the purges ripping through his society, Stalin deployed his network of spies across the major industrialized nations around the world.
So when you say spies, what sort of types of spy are you talking about here?
Okay, so the way they were categorized were either legal or illegal spies. The legal spy was based inside an embassy or a consulate, and he enjoyed diplomatic cover. So they established what was called a residentura, which was a sort of like a intelligence organization based within the embassy. And the resident, who was the guy in charge, he would conduct intelligence operations, and he'd run agents. If he was unmasked, as a spy. The worst that could happen was basically being kicked out of the country, being declared persona non grata and expelled because he enjoyed diplomatic immunity. There might be a bit of a row about it, but hey, that sort of thing happens. He'd often be there under an alias and working perhaps as a cultural attaché or something like that to give him a cover story. But he'd enjoy the contacts of the diplomatic community, which were useful in his job, but also the technical communications and logistics all around the embassy. He would then support illegal officers. Now, these were guys living under deep cover in the country that they were based. They had an assumed identity, a cover story, a job, perhaps a family, a home, and they had no diplomatic immunity, so they were basically out in the cold. If they were caught spying, they would then face the full force of the law, that they weren't protected by those diplomatic niceties. A subset of those was the sleeper agent. Now, a sleeper agent would be placed in society and would establish this covering identity over many years, building a life without doing any espionage, and then waiting for the day when he'd get the call through some kind of agreed communications medium, where they would be activated by the centre and they'd take on a particular mission. The legal of officers, or the illegals, they would in turn run agents. Now, the agent was at the coalface. They did the actual intelligence gathering. They steal information, perhaps from their colleagues or their employers. Agents would be recruited. There's a whole sort of like lexicon of words associated with the world of espionage. They'd be recruited, and now they could be motivated by ideology. So obviously communism was attractive to a lot of people back in the 1930s, or attracted by financial reward, or even they could be entrapped, forced into spying by blackmail for some incident that would be held against them. They all would communicate with their handlers by using communications protocols known as tradecraft. These are techniques that would allow the safe transfer of information from agent to handler. And the resident might also use couriers, so that there would be an additional cutout between him and the agent. Couriers were also illegal agents working under deep cover.
Were they using the local communist parties of each country to assist them?
Well, that was a thing. The Communist Party of Great Britain, the CPGB, and the same in the USA, they were in effect outstations of Soviet intelligence. They had political objectives. You know, they were there to raise the profile of the of communism and the Communist International, which was the international movement to promote communism as a state of mind, as a state of policy. But these political parties also served as logistics and communication hubs for agents under the noses of the authorities. And then there was also something called a front organisation. Now, these were legitimate businesses, often operating quite above board, perhaps a shipping concern, a travel agent, but a business that allowed a agent to operate in plain sight. So, for example, working for a shipping company, an agent could travel around the country, meeting various people, picking things up, returning to headquarters. It was basically a classic way of operating an intelligence network under a assumed organisation.
Which spy gave the Soviets the first indication of the development of nuclear weapons in the West?
In late 1940, reports began to filter through that the British were working on a project to exploit this military potential of nuclear physics. The first atomic spy, if you like, he was actually part of a very famous group of spies, the Cambridge Five. These were guys who were recruited at Cambridge University in the 1930s. drawn to communism for often sort of naive ideological reasons, but they proved to be some of the most important spies of the early Cold War. All of them were recruited when they were young, but they sort of developed their careers and they managed to secure important jobs in the British establishment, using quite often the old school tie or the old boys network. The five were Kim Philby. Now, he established a career in the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, otherwise known as MI6. A guy called Donald MacLean, he built a career in the Foreign Office. A guy called Guy Burgess, now he had a sort of bit of a checkered career, but he did some time at the BBC, also for SIS and also in the Foreign Office. A guy called Anthony Blunt, he became a leading voice in the art world, but had close links with the royal family. And a guy called John Cairncross, he worked in the Cabinet Office. Now, the Cabinet Office is really at the heart of British government. All these guys, I'm sure most people will have heard about these famous spies, but it was Cairncross who broke the story to the Soviets about the atomic bomb project. He was private secretary to a guy called Maurice Hankey, Sir Maurice Hankey. Now, Hankey was a very grand title, the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which is a rather vague position, but he had an awful lot of power. He oversaw the British intelligence agencies and also chaired the government's Scientific Advisory Committee. Now, this was very much the top of the scientific tree in the United Kingdom. They advised the government on policy and they controlled really the direction of science in the United Kingdom. They, as part of that, they oversaw tube alloys, which was, of course, the atomic bomb project. So with John Cairncross, Stalin's long-term slow burn, if you like, investment in intelligence had hit the jackpot. John Cairncross, anything that landed on Sir Maurice's desk would be copied by John Cairncross and handed to the Soviets. Later on in the war, Donald MacLean, another of the Cambridge Five, he'd also become a source of atomic secrets.
Yeah, Cairncross is an interesting character because, I mean, he also told the Soviets about Enigma and the breaking of the German codes as well. So, you know, he's probably the lesser-known member of the Cambridge Five, but one of the most devastating in terms of his betrayal.
Yeah, he was one of the last to be outed. Philby was... He defected in 1963. It was all very public. Burgess and MacLean defected in 51, I think it was. So these guys had high profiles, basically because they defected in public. Anthony Blunt was outed much later on, and Cairncross, it was all very much under the radar. But that's obviously, that worked for, well, it worked for him, it worked for the Soviets, and later on it worked for the British government too.
Yeah, brush it under the carpet.
Absolutely.
So what did the Soviets do with this valuable information?
Well, in a very Soviet way, they had paranoia at the highest levels of government, and this delayed their starting their own atomic bomb project. Basically, Lavrenty Beria, now he's a terrible man, he was head of the NKVD. There could be a whole podcast on his exploits, but he was receiving this information, but because of this inherent paranoia, he believed it was Western disinformation. So rather than push it upstairs to his boss, Stalin, he sat on it, which is an extraordinary thing to do, but this guy was at the heart of Soviet government.
I mean, they had quite a mistrust of the Cambridge Five as well, from what I remember. They were worried that there was disinformation coming from them. So their paranoia knew no boundaries, really.
No, and it begs the question that if they acted on all the information and took it as real, what changes there would have been to Soviet policy, Soviet actions during those years. But yeah, you're right. They discounted a lot of genuine information just because they believed it was a plant.
So were the Soviets getting information from other sources that helped them piece together the fact that this was a real project rather than just relying on Cairncross's information?
Yes. So over in Moscow, on one hand, you had Beria sitting on these reports because he believed they were made up, but the reports were going through to various different departments within the Soviet intelligence apparatus. And their top scientific spymaster, a guy called Leonid Kvasnikov, he was seeing so much information through. He did a very brave thing, went out on a limb and ordered, this was in March 1942, he ordered his residences in London and New York to basically find out what was going on, find out what these physicists were up to. And this basically triggered Stalin's masterstroke, if you like, that this investment was suddenly paying off. So there was this guy called Jacob Golos. Now, he was an old school communist. He was one of the founding members of the Communist Party of the United States. He ran one of these front organizations, a travel agent. So the first, if you like, step on this journey of the atomic spies in the States, he recruited this American industrial chemist, a guy called Harry Gold. Now, as well as obviously trying to secure secrets on the atomic program, Stalin was basically after any industrial or military secret because he needed that information to kickstart his economy. So yeah, this guy actually started off as an industrial spy, stealing industrial secrets in the sugar industry, would you believe? He also built Golos, built a network of agents around a guy called Julius Rosenberg. Now, he was an electrical engineer and also a communist. He was talent spotted and groomed by Golos to start working within the US military on the technical side. Rosenberg got this job at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey and began passing secrets to the Soviets on secret US military communications systems. Julius didn't stop at that, though. He recruited like-minded friends at Fort Monmouth and other military contractors. These were guys that he went to school with, he knew through the communist social network, if you like. So he started off being a spy himself, an agent, but then pretty soon he started to become a courier, acting between these friends of his and the NKV resident, a guy called Semyon Semyonov, who was responsible for technical intelligence in the US. So at this stage, they weren't dabbling in the world of nuclear science, but they were still bringing in a lot of valuable military tech to the Soviets. Following that call by Kvasnikov in Moscow, Semyonov, there's lots of great Soviet names here, Russian names, but he directed Rosenberg to make contacts within the Manhattan Project. And Rosenberg would actually be very successful in this task. His first spy was a guy called Russell McNutt. Now, McNutt is a fairly unknown atomic spy. There were some very big names later on, but he was the first. He was a civil engineer, and he got a job with a company called, well, the Kellex Corporation. Now, they were a engineering company who were tasked with building the huge uranium enrichment plant at Oak Ridge, as I said, Oak Ridge in Tennessee. And as I said earlier, there was a massive industrial arm to the Manhattan Project that doesn't really get much coverage. He was a civil engineer. He wasn't involved in weapons physics, but he had the title of the Soviet Union's first spy inside the Manhattan Project. And he was able to give layouts and structural drawings of this Oak Ridge plant, which was vitally important to the bomb process. Rosenberg's second spy was a guy called Oscar Sibora. Now, he joined the Manhattan Project as part of the Special Engineering Detachment, the SED. This was a group, this was a US Army organization, talented engineers who would work on the actual construction of the bombs. Again, he wasn't a weapons physics guy, but he was on the practical side, the manufacturing of the bomb. So his intelligence, I think what we see here is layers of information that people at the very top of the intelligence tree would then piece together a much bigger picture. So each small source had incredible value when viewed as a whole. Sabora was present at the Trinity test, and he was only one of four Soviet agents at Los Alamos. So Los Alamos was the scientific center of the Manhattan Project down in New Mexico. So four agents worked inside Los Alamos, which was supposed to be one of the most secure places on the planet. Only goes to show. Rosenberg's third agent, he didn't have to look too far. His brother-in-law, David Greenglass. Now, Greenglass was a fellow communist. He also got a job with the SED, the Special Engineering Detachment, at Los Alamos. And he was working on the explosive lenses that were used to use the implosion technique to detonate the plutonium bomb. Now, Rosenberg paid his sister, Ruth, to go down to New Mexico and live close to Los Alamos so she could act as a courier for his espionage. But the resident in New York thought that was too risky, so organized for this guy called Harry Gold, who we've already mentioned, the industrial chemist that working in the sugar business, to be his courier. As it happened, Gold was already working with a spy at Los Alamos, a British guy, British scientist, who we'll learn about in a minute. But in a lovely bit of tradecraft, this is classic tradecraft, they took a box of Jell-O, or jelly as we call it in the UK. They tore that box in half. One half was given to Greenglass and the other half was given to Gold. So when Gold travelled down to New Mexico, he would present this torn cardboard box with a nice ragged edge, and that it could be matched up with the box that Greenglass had, proving who they were, and they could talk to each other about the mission. So a lovely bit of tradecraft. And that Jell-O box was evidence in their trial much later on. So David Greenglass gave masses of information on the operation at Los Alamos, how it was structured, what buildings did what, and also he gave them information on the detonation process.
I think you mentioned earlier that the Soviets sort of pieced this together from various other sources. So there's not just these agents involved. There's other agents also providing information to the NKVD.
Yeah, that's a key point. None of these agents knew that the others were in operating. As far as each of them were concerned, they were the only spy at the heart of the project. But there were loads, as we'll see in due course. For example, there was a guy called Ted Hall. Now, he was a young guy, a physics prodigy. He was headhunted to go and work at Los Alamos at the tender age of 19, would you believe? But he might have been a sort of like a physics genius, but he was politically naive and he saw communism as the way forward. So he was taken on at the Manhattan Project, but he also then offered his services to Soviet intelligence. To start with, he used a friend of his called Saville Sachs as his courier, and he actually passed some really big information across. Details on implosion, for example. This was the technique used to detonate the plutonium bomb. Now, implosion was such a new concept to the world at the time. When they came to translate it into Russian, there wasn't actually a word in the Russian dictionary for this thing, so they had to invent a word. It just shows you how new this science was. But this was the first the Soviets learnt about a plutonium bomb, and that was broken by this Ted Hall guy. As the project was nearing its completion, this amateur courier with Savile Sachs, the resident thought, hang on a second, this is a bit risky. We can't have amateurs involved. We need to get a pro along. So this double act was put to one side, and the resident assigned this experienced courier to handle Ted Hall's material. This was a lady called Lona Cohen, and she appears in the Portland Spy saga, which I know you've talked about on this podcast. But he gave her, for example, diagrams of the actual bombs, the Fat Man, the plutonium bomb that was used at Nagasaki, Little Boy, the uranium bomb that was used at Hiroshima. He actually handed over diagrams of these bombs to Lona Cohen.
Lona is an interesting character. In fact, I interviewed a KGB illegal that had had some training off Lona Cohen, and also her husband, Morris Cohen, in Moscow. It was really interesting speaking to somebody who actually met them. So I will be giving details of the relevant episodes for any connections here in the episode notes. From what I hear, most of these spies were not sort of like trained to be spies. They were sort of like amateurs working on the side. Did the Soviets have anybody who had specifically been trained for this role?
Most of the training went to the handlers, the people who were operating these agents, and they would then pass their knowledge on down to the agents. So yes, you're right, they're mostly amateur spies, albeit trained by professionals. But there was one guy, so this is the next atomic spy in the mix, a chap called George Caval. He was actually a professionally trained GRU agent. He was born in the US. His family emigrated to the Soviet Union in the 1930s. He grew up, he was trained as a spy, and then sent back to the US, where he started operating as a spy. He managed to get himself posted to the Manhattan Project, again, part of this SED technology group, and was assigned as a health physics officer to Oak Ridge. Now, this was a really important job. Basically, he was there to monitor radioactivity around the site and make sure that there were no potential health risks. It was all very basic in those days, but at least they had somebody there with a Geiger counter going around checking what was happening. But as a result, he had an access all areas pass. He had his own Jeep. He could come and go as he pleased. Now, that's just an absolute godsend for a spy, because it meant he could dip his fingers into pies all over the site. He was able to monitor polonium production. Now, polonium is a element that's used in the as an initiator in the plutonium bomb. He was able to identify that polonium was being shipped from Oak Ridge to Los Alamos. Now, for the Soviets, that was the first positive link they had between Oak Ridge and the Los Alamos site in New Mexico. That was a major bit of intelligence. He was also then posted to Dayton, Ohio, to a polonium manufacturing facility operated by Monsanto. Did the same job. And as a result, he could really talk about this initiator part of the bomb, which obviously without that, the bomb would not go off. So we've actually got five spies within the Manhattan Project so far. So we've got Russell McNutt. He's this civil engineer with the Kellex Corporation. Oscar Sabora, he's with the SED at Los Alamos. Greenglass, again with the SED. Ted Hall is this physics prodigy at Los Alamos. And George Caval, who's going around with his Geiger counter, measuring radiation and monitoring everything that he sees. In addition, we've got Rosenberg, who was a spy who then became a sort of ringleader and courier. We had Harry Gold, who was courier for Greenglass, plus this British spy we'll talk about in a minute, and our friend Lona Cohen, who couriered for Hall.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. You mentioned earlier a British spy at Los Alamos, but there was more than one there.
Well, we're talking about Klaus Fuchs, of course. He was one of the British spies, so therefore there's more to come. So Klaus Fuchs was a refugee from the Nazis, a theoretical physicist. The difference was he wasn't a Jewish refugee. He was actually a communist refugee. So he fled the Nazis because of his political beliefs, not because of his race. Now, he was a very talented physicist. He arrived in the UK and was able to start his career again. And after a couple of false starts, was able to join Tube Alloys, specialising in the really important gaseous diffusion method of enriching uranium. Uranium, when it comes out of the ground, is no use at all for an atomic bomb. It has to be very refined to make it usable. The isotopes need to be separated. So unless that can be done, you've got no bomb. So after the Soviets switched sides, in June 1941, basically the Germans reneged on their agreement, invaded the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union joins the war against the Nazis. A lot of scientists, Fuchs being one of them, but also Ted Hall, we've just talked about as well, they thought it was wrong that these atomic secrets were not being shared with the Soviets. Because basically the Americans and British didn't want to pass those secrets on. They thought it was wrong. They thought it was their duty to basically share the information. So that's the ideological motivation.
And also, technically, we were allies with the Soviet Union at that point. So you can see some logic there.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, these guys were very, very intelligent people, but they believed in the sort of like a universal science community. Well, actually, of course, as soon as the war started, all the shutters came down and it all became very compartmentalized and it became a state secret. So, yeah, you're right. They wanted to share the information with their allies, albeit motivated by a belief in communism. So Klaus Fuchs was operating in the Tube Alloys project. He didn't know anybody within the communist sort of setup in the UK. Met this guy at a party who was the exiled leader of the German Communist Party, a guy called Jürgen Kaczynski. Now, Kaczynski was actually still very much involved in espionage, and he passed Fuchs on to the GRU resident in London, who then assigned a handler called Semyon Kramer. Now, Fuchs was a prolific spy. I mean, he was passing over reams and reams of information, details of experiments, industrial processes, calculations of how they were going to separate the different isotopes of uranium, and also how they were operating with the Manhattan Project, how it was all being coordinated. So Kramer was suddenly recalled to Moscow, disappeared off the face of the earth. Fuchs then started working with a lady called Ursula Kaczynski. Now, he didn't know her as Ursula Kaczynski. He knew her as Ursula Burton. Now, she was known as Agent Sonia, who is, again, quite a famous spy. Books been written about her. And, of course, she was Jürgen's sister. But Fuchs did not know this. He continued to hand over masses of information to her. She installed a transmitter at her house in Oxfordshire, so she was able to transmit quite a lot of information. But the pages and pages of complex calculations that Fuchs was providing had to be handed to the GRU resident in London. They were then put in the diplomatic bag, shipped to Moscow, and then, of course, the scientists over there could try and interpret the information. So intelligence was starting to flood into Moscow. And despite Beria's caution, despite him being paranoid that it was all a disinformation campaign, it found its way into the State Defense Committee. Now, these guys were pretty powerful, and they sort of overruled Beria's caution and proposed an atomic bomb project to work in parallel. So this is September 1942. A guy called Igor Kurchatov was to head this project, and he was given the task of taking all this intelligence and converting it into their own bomb.
Now, I do have a tenuous connection with Klaus Fuchs, and it is tenuous, but when I lived in North London, I used to drink in the same pub that he met his courier. So the Nag's Head in Wood Green, I drank in. I never saw any shady-looking KGB people in there, but maybe I wasn't looking in the right place. But that's my only claim to a link with Klaus Fuchs.
Well, if you I haven't got it sort of in front of me, but there are details, the tradecraft routines that the guy would use. So in this pub that you mentioned, it's mentioned in the archives, it talks about something like drinking a pint of Guinness or holding a particular newspaper or a tennis ball in one hand and a pair of gloves in the other. I mean, it's really bizarre stuff. But yeah, you're right. That pub was mentioned, and the routines they had to go to identify each other sound quite comical now. But actually, if you think about it in the context of what they were doing, it was, you know, real life or death stuff.
Brilliant, brilliant. Tennis ball in a North London pub.
So all that drinking you did in those days, it was obviously setting you up for this podcast.
Yeah, little did I know that was going to be a useful bit of, well, a completely useless piece of trivia. but Fuchs wasn't the only British spy. There's others.
Yeah, there was. And again, all these guys were operating in parallel. They had no knowledge of each other. So Fuchs was really kick-started the atomic bomb project. But there was another guy called Alan Nunn May. Now, he was, an experimental physicist, but he was a secret communist. He joined Tube Alloys and headed over to Canada in January 1943. Basically, Tube Alloys upped sticks and moved over to North America as the war progressed. They needed the resources over in the US and Canada. And also from a security point of view, safety from German bombs, it made sense to locate these guys where it was much safer. So Nunn May moved to Canada. He started working at the Chalk River Laboratory in Ottawa in Canada, but also he got involved at the Argonne Laboratories in Chicago, which was part of the University of Chicago. And also the DuPont facility in Hanford, Washington State, which is where there were reactors producing plutonium. Now, he passed extensive details of the Canadian reactor program. He gave them samples of the isotopes that were being split as part of the refining process. And all these were couriered to Moscow. He gave details of plutonium stocks at Hanford, for example. And he was there at the Trinity test. He had reports of the atomic bombs dropped on Japan. His reports arrived in Moscow only a couple of days after the actual bomb. So, you know, he was actually quite an important part of this whole story. The third British guy, was a guy called Bruno Pontecorvo. Now, he was an Italian-British Jewish communist physicist. He had quite a illustrious career in Italy. He worked with Enrico Fermi, who was a very famous nuclear physicist. But he had to flee the sort of fascist tendency that was growing in Italy as well as in Germany. He ended up in Canada. And he started working on the NRX heavy water moderated reactor at Chalk River. basically the Manhattan Project was looking at different types of technology. So they were looking at graphite-moderated reactors, which were being developed at Hanford, but they also used this heavy water-moderated reactor as an experimental thing, and Pontecorvo was working on that. So he arrived, he was a committed communist, he knocked on the door of the embassy in Ottawa and eventually got the attention of the NKVD resident, or it was the NKGB then, and he would go on to give the Soviets details of Fermi's famous experiment, which was the first controllable nuclear reaction. Without a controllable reaction, you can't have a reactor. You therefore can't produce plutonium for a bomb. He also provided details of the Canadian reactor and gave actual samples of these isotopes. Now, again, our friend Lona Cohen, who we met earlier, she was his courier. So she picked up these radioactive samples and passed them via the diplomatic bag to Moscow. So, in late 1943, Fuchs learned that he was going to move from the UK, the Tubal Alloys organisation, move over to the North America to work with the Manhattan Project. Basically, all his colleagues, as I said, upsticked and move over there. By now, he'd become a British naturalised citizen. He was a civil servant, so he passed multiple security vetting. So he had his top secret clearance. None of them had picked up that he was a communist. And all this time, he was handing secrets to the Soviets. So a major mistake by the British security services, shall we say, to say the least. When Fuchs arrived in the States, he was actually taken on by the NKVD. So in the UK, he was being run by the GRU, but there was sort of like a turf war, and the NKVD won. Fuchs started to work at Columbia University, and because his expertise was in this gaseous diffusion, the way of refining uranium, he also worked a lot with the guys at Oak Ridge in Tennessee. His handler was Semyon Semyonov, who, if you remember, we talked about earlier because he worked with the Rosenbergs. Another name, Harry Gold. Well, we talked about Harry Gold acting as a courier for David Greenglass. Well, they allocated Gold as Fuchs's courier. Now, that might have been perhaps a good use of resources, having one person handling two agents. But this connection would actually prove to be their undoing, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Fuchs, he was a model agent. He basically, anything the Soviets wanted, he gave them. So he gave them details of experiments, timetables, the processes. He gave them plans with detailed dimensions. And he had almost like a photographic memory, so he could write down really, really complicated formula out of his head, that he could then pass on. And he had a strange situation that he would be meeting in a perhaps a restaurant with Harry Gold. Gold would then skip out of the restaurant, nip round the corner, talk to Semyonov or one of his colleagues, get some questions, then nip back into the restaurant, ask the questions, and then nip back round the corner to deliver the answers. It was almost like a charade, if you like, but it was the way they worked. And Fuchs was a prolific provider. When Fuchs then was posted down to Los Alamos, Harry Gold went with him. So down in Los Alamos, Fuchs gave Gold details of the Los Alamos setup. Now, all these information, it's important to think, all these different spies that we've talked about created layers of knowledge. And so obviously now Fuchs arrives down at Los Alamos. He's a very observant guy. He describes what he sees. That then can be compared and contrasted by the guys back in Moscow to create this overall picture. So it's all little parts of this jigsaw. Although, to be fair, Fuchs was a really, really big part of that jigsaw. He betrayed the spec of the plutonium bomb. He gave, you know, real precise details of the Trinity gadget and the Fat Man bomb, including this implosion method, which was like such an important part of the process. Hall we talked about earlier, Ted Hall, he also gave information on implosion, albeit from a slightly different perspective. Again, that helped them recreate the device. And Greenglass and Sabora, we talked about earlier, they talked about the actual mechanicals of how it all worked. So you can see all these different parts of the jigsaw helping the Soviet project under Kurchatov come together. The crazy thing, when you look back in hindsight, security at Los Alamos was incredibly tight. As I said, it's probably the most secure patch of real estate in the world. But Fuchs was allowed to own a car, which was quite rare. Certainly it was rare in Los Alamos, but it was reasonably rare in the 1940s. But he was let out of the secure compound once a month to go shopping in Santa Fe without supervision, which again is an incredible oversight if you viewing in hindsight. Santa Fe as a city, as a town, was packed full of FBI in plain clothes. It was like a counterintelligence nightmare, if you like. But somehow Gold was able to meet Fuchs. They rendezvoused on a bridge in the middle of Santa Fe, for example, and Fuchs carried on passing over reams and reams of intelligence. He talked about, for example, how they overcame this instability inside the bomb with the physics. It could have completely derailed the project, but they found that they could use certain combinations of metals to overcome this problem. Now, that could have held the Soviet bomb project up for years, but Fuchs handed it to them on a silver platter. Fuchs was also able to give details of early research on the super, which is the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear bomb. And that was very important for kickstarting that process in the Soviet Union as well.
So it sounds like, without doubt, Fuchs was the most devastating of all the atomic spies. Would that be a fair thing to say?
I think he was probably the most prolific, and because of his position within the the top scientific group at Los Alamos, he was privy to all the scientific secrets. Ted Hall, who we talked about earlier, was also pretty influential as well, but Fuchs, I think, trumped him just really because of the mass of information. Also, Fuchs had this photographic memory as well, so he could deliver really, really complicated equations and things, which, of course, the scientists in Moscow could then interpret. So, yeah, he was probably the most devastating aspect.
So we've not spoken about my... If you could have favourite atomic spies, I think that this... The one that hopefully we're going to talk about in a moment is my favourite. The one that was nicknamed the spy that came in from the co-op.
Yeah, now perhaps international listeners might not know what the co-op is. The co-op is a cooperative supermarket chain that was, well, still exists, but it was always very much viewed as a part of provincial England. It's a very British organisation. Anyway, yes, the lady you're talking about, your favourite spy, is a lady called Melita Norwood, known as Letty. She was a classic part of espionage history. She was probably one of the longest serving Soviet spies. She operated from 1937, now wait for this, right through to 1972. That's a hell of a career working, you know, under the radar, deep cover, risking her freedom every day. So that's a massive contribution to Soviet espionage. She was only exposed in 1999 by the publication of the Mitrokhin archives.
The Mitrokhin archive is a collection of handwritten notes, primary sources and official documents that were secretly made, smuggled and hidden by KGB archivist Vasily Mitrokhin during the 30 years that he served in the KGB Foreign Intelligence Service. When he defected to the UK in 1992, he brought the entire archive with him in 6 full trunks.
Melita Norwood was outed as a spy at the age of 87, little old lady. She was also called the grandma spy as well. There's a film called Red Joan you might have seen, starring Judi Dench, which is a fictionalized story about her. But yeah, she was very much the spy who came in from the co-op. She flew under the radar of authorities by virtue of her gender. Basically, the male-dominated establishment couldn't conceive that a female would be a spy. That was also how Ursula Kosinski was able to be so successful. She used her gender to camouflage her activity. Norwood was also relatively lowly in the organization. She was a secretary. Now, she was able to move under the radar, but her betrayal was certainly as great as her male colleagues. Norwood worked for the British Non-Ferrous Metals Research Association, which sounds a bit obscure, but they were a research group, and they took sort of contract research, metallurgical research, from a whole bunch of different clients. One of them was Tube Alloys. Despite having communist connections, her sister was an out-and-out communist, and Letty was a closet communist, shall we say. She passed vetting, and she was actually given a security clearance. And she rose through the Non-Ferrous Metals Research Association to become a personal assistant to the director. She had keys to his safe. She was able to pop in when they were out, open the safe, take out documents. She had one of those Minox spy cameras. She'd snap documents and pass them back to her handler. And her handler was no less than Ursula Kosinski, Agent Sonia, who we met. So there's all these lovely connections between all these different spies.
Prior to the Soviets detonating their atom bomb in 1949, were there suspicions that any spies were there, and were, you know, any investigations going on after the war prior to that point, and when, you know, the Cold War was starting to appear?
Yeah, so the Second World War ended. The Manhattan Project, in its sort of like wartime fervor, started to wind down, and all these individuals, all these scientists and our atomic spies all went their separate ways. Again, I've said this before, but it's important. None of them knew that there were loads of other spies there. So it was interesting that they all disappeared off to start their new lives in the knowledge that they were, you know, the only spy. Actually, they weren't. They were part of actually quite a group of spies, but compartmentalization meant that that they were kept in the dark, which actually worked quite well from a security point of view. So at the end of the war, the Americans decided to stop cooperating with the British. Now, that's a bit of a sad situation when the British had contributed so much to the project, but that was the reality in this new world order, if you like. So the British contingent, Fuchs being one of them, returned to the UK. Most of them were to stay in the world of atomic physics, either in the official government organisation, which was the UK Atomic Energy Research Establishment at Harwell in Oxfordshire, or working in academia or in other industries. When Fuchs returned, he continued his espionage. So he returned. He was this time handled by the MGB, which is the next iteration of the NKVD saga. And his handler was called Alexander Feklisov. Bruno Pontecorvo, we talked about before, he also started working at Harwell, but none may. He started working at King's College in London as a professor. The American spies who we've talked about, most of them were in the military. They were demobbed and they started whatever life. Ted Hall went back into academia. So, yeah, they scattered all over the world.
These people disappear into, let's say, academic obscurity. But with that detonation of that bomb, the US and the British know that there were agents within the Manhattan Project and elsewhere. Where's the first lead that starts to roll up this network?
Well, it actually starts before the bomb, before the Soviet bomb. So that was August 1949. If you think of intelligence networks, they are very fragile structures. I use the analogy of like a house of cards. All you need to do is weaken one of the cards at the bottom and the whole lot falls down. Now, that's basically what happened with our Soviet espionage network. The first to fall was a guy called was Alan Nunmay. Now, he was identified by a Soviet spy who defected. He was a GRU cipher clerk working in Canada, a guy called Igor Guzenko. And he defected in September 1945. So we're talking just after the bombs. When they actually reviewed the material that he smuggled out as he escaped, it pointed to Nunmay. There was no question. He was delivering secrets to the Canadian resident. So he was put under surveillance by the Canadian Mounted Police, and then when Nunmay returned to the UK, which happened, I think, in October 1945. He was surveilled by the MI5 literally as soon as he climbed down the steps of the aircraft. The documents that Guzenko handed over had indicated that Nunmay was supposed to check in with his new handlers in the UK. Basically, Fuchs. All the agents were given protocols to basically start their spying action when they got back into the UK. So Nunmay was supposed to rendezvous with his new handlers in October. But the dates that he was supposed to be there, the main date and the two fallback dates, the handlers were nowhere to be seen. Nunmay just went about his normal daily life. So something had happened. It transpired that Kim Philby, who we mentioned earlier, one of the Cambridge Five, he was very senior at SIS. He found out that basically Nunmay was under suspicion. He managed to warn Nunmay to not turn up with his handlers, warned the handlers to stay well away, and basically, yeah, they managed to dodge that bullet. But it didn't last very long because Nunmay was interviewed by Special Branch in February 1946. They basically presented a slam dunk case, presented the evidence, and he had no option but to confess. So he confessed to working for the Soviets, but he refused to cooperate. He wouldn't name names. So when he was sent to trial, which was May 1946, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for contravening the Official Secrets Act. This was the first indication that the Manhattan Project had been penetrated. The Americans reacted badly to this news that a British agent had basically sold their secrets, as they saw it, and they shut the British out. The next step in this collapsing house of cards was actually led by cryptography, code breakers. Now, during the Second World War, I think you mentioned earlier about Bletchley Park and Enigma, the code breakers made a major contribution to winning the war. And it would be a code breaker who actually brought down the rest of these spies. The project was called Venona. So in 1943, we go back to the Second World War, the US Army Security Agency, ASA, which is a forerunner to the NSA that we have nowadays, began to decode Soviet diplomatic traffic that they were sending between Moscow and their US consulates. What often is the case, it all fell down by a silly administrative error by the guys who produced these cipher pads, these one-time pads, meant that the codes that were meant to be random and therefore unbreakable started to show patterns, and cryptographers love patterns. This simple mistake gave the cryptographers at the ASA a foot in the door. It gave them a way in to the code, and they started to decode, intercept, make sense of some of these thousands of messages that were being passed. The golden period, if you like, was between 1942 and 1944, which of course was when a lot of the atomic spying was going on. After that, the corrected pads went back into circulation, so it all went dark, but they had about 3,000 messages that they could work with. In December 1946, the codebreakers in the States partially decoded a December 1944 message between New York and Moscow, which listed, would you believe it, Manhattan Project scientists. So this was irrefutable proof that the project had been penetrated, but also that the traffic, the signals traffic, these 3,000 messages that they'd trawled, was actually much more than just diplomatic chit-chat talking about the next cocktail party. It was really important espionage. So for the next couple of years, the pieces of this enormous jigsaw began to fall into place. And I think a bit like the scale of the Manhattan Project, it's quite easy to underestimate just the huge task these codebreakers took on. They brought GCHQ in, the British codebreaking group, the successors to the guys at Bletchley Park. They brought in the FBI on the counterintelligence side. And it's an extraordinary feat of both codebreaking and detective work that they identified 349 suspects. That's all hidden behind code names, which is a huge thing, but they still had to whittle away. It was an incredibly painstaking, slow job. But by linking code names with activities, with dates, with places, all of a sudden a picture started to emerge. Now, Venona was a massive secret. It was leaked in the 1980s as a concept, but it was only declassified in 1995. So just shows you what a big secret this was. The first to fall as part of this thing was Klaus Fuchs, a German scientist. His code name was Charles, but also was Rest. Those are the code names. Those names started to appear in decrypts. The Venona team, by September 1949, had linked these code names, Charles and Rest, to his sister, who was also a sort of a bit of a courier involved in this mix. Her code name was Ant. Her name was Crystal, and also linked in with Harry Gold, whose code name was Goose. So these code names, Charles, Ant, and Goose, all started to be linked together in communication. That pinpointed that it could only really be one person, who had one guy who had a sister in the States, who were meeting up these people on this particular day, and they closed in on him at Harwell. And after what was a lengthy sort of gradual interrogation, it was very low key, they started talking to him, started introducing bits of evidence, building trust, and ultimately Fuchs confessed and was arrested. This was February 1950. So this code-breaking detective thing had got their first victim. Fuchs went on trial the following month, was convicted and sentenced to just 14 years in prison. Now, we talked about Fuchs being perhaps the most damaging spy, but because of the way the English law works, he was convicted under the Official Secrets Act, and the maximum amount they could sentence him was 14 years. So it's just obviously an indication of the limitations, perhaps, of the English justice system. The second weak link was Harry Gold. Now, he, as I said, he was implicated in this investigation with Fuchs. He was identified, some very clever detective work, pinpointed Harry Gold, and he was arrested in May and sent May 1950 and was sentenced to 10 years in prison at the end of that year.
You mentioned Harry Gold with Fuchs there. Did he lead them on to others?
Yeah, the best way of thinking about this is a cascade. So again, Fuchs was found out because of the detective work around the Venona codes. Harry Gold was connected to Fuchs because his name appeared in the same messages, and he was the next weak link. And his undoing then led to a whole load of other people being discovered. So it's very much a domino approach, a domino situation. So Gold was arrested in May 1950 He was sentenced to 10 years in prison in December 1950. So he basically confessed and he cooperated. He implicated David Greenglass, who was the next guy. Now, Greenglass's wife, Ruth, she was a fellow communist. She was a peripheral member of this espionage ring, if you like. But they used her as leverage, and they said they were going to throw the book at her, put her in prison and throw away the key. Greenglass was offered an opportunity to basically sell out his brother-in-law, Julius Rosenberg. Now, it was a very cynical move, and you know it's been much analysed and criticised in later years, but it basically kept his wife, Ruth, out of prison. But it implicated both Rosenberg, Julius Rosenberg, and his wife, Ethel. And, well, we'll talk about their fate in a second. But Greenglass was convicted in April 1951 and was given 15 years in prison. So Rosenberg, implicated by his brother-in-law, was arrested in July 1950. Ethel was arrested the following month. Both of them refused to cooperate, and there was a sensational trial. Both were found guilty under the 1917 Espionage Act. This is quite a draconian measure put in during the First World War, but was pulled out for these particular guys. They were given special treatment, and both of them were sentenced to death. After multiple appeals, they were both executed in June 1953, sent to the electric chair after President Eisenhower refused the last appeal for clemency. Massively controversial move. I don't think anybody thought it would ever get that far, but it gained its own momentum, and basically Eisenhower had no option but to let the execution go ahead. It's still debated today in on campuses across the US, and basically anybody involved in international law, the Rosenberg case is still actively debated today.
I've got an episode on the Rosenbergs and their trial, so I will add that to the episode notes as well. There's going to be a chunky number of episodes in the episode notes.
I think that just shows really how everything's interconnected, and that's what makes it so interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. Arathas revealed through Venona as well.
Well, all these code names cropped up, and of course there were 3,000 messages, and they were only decoding really slowly. They'd also only partially decode certain messages, so there would be these tantalising code names appearing next to a load of gobbledygook. So, yeah, it was very much a ticking time bomb, if you like, for the spies. Most of them, however, decided to do something about it and jumped before they were caught. So the first was George Cavell. So do you remember, he was our professional GRU agent. He was demobbed after the war, returned to New York, and then in October 1948, okay, this is prior to Fuchs being found out, he jumps on a ship to go to Europe on holiday, to go work in Europe or something, disappears off the face of the earth, is never heard of again. So he undoubtedly defected back to the USSR and began a new life there under a different identity. Lona Cohen, who we talked about, our friend Lona, she and her husband, Morris, they got out just after Fuchs was arrested. So before that, the connections were able to be made. They surfaced a few years later in London under a assumed identity, and that's the... You got an episode on the Portland Spies?
I've got two episodes on the Portland Spies, actually. So, yeah, that's another intriguing espionage story that will be in the episode notes.
So Lona and Morris basically resurface in London as Helen and Peter Kroger, but that's, again, another story. Oscar Sabora, he was one of the SED guys. Basically, he defected in late 1951. So really, 1950, 51, 52, 53, that's where it all starts to fall apart. Ted Hall, our physics prodigy, well, he basically returned to academia. Now, the FBI had suspicions about him and also his chum, Saville Sachs, but they could never prove it. And so basically, although Hall was actually a really damaging spy, perhaps not quite as bad as Fuchs, but he was, you know, up there because he was giving theoretical information on the plutonium bomb. They couldn't bring him to justice, so he actually escaped. Our friend McNutt, Russell McNutt, he died in 2008 without having been identified. He was actually only outed the year after his death, when he was included in a book about the atomic bomb. So he basically managed to escape justice. Ursula Kaczynski, who appears throughout this story, Agent Sonia, a legendary part of Soviet intelligence, she defected or escaped in February 1950. Again, that's prior to Klaus Fuchs's arrest. And she settled in East Germany and basically lived her life out. She was actually a children's author for a while anyway. Bruno Pontecorvo, we talked about him. He was suspected, but couldn't, again, there wasn't enough proof to bring him to justice. What they did was they put him in a sort of relatively obscure academic position, away from any secrets. He realised that he was under suspicion. So in September 1950, while he was on holiday with his family, he defected and disappeared. We have Donald McLean, who basically used his position in the US embassy in Washington to pass atomic secrets to his handler. He was one of the famous Cambridge spies. He defected with his fellow spy Guy Burgess in May 1951, and that was a really dramatic defection that was all over the news. John Cairncross, the interesting spy who was the first to alert Moscow of the bomb project, he was never brought to trial. So, again, like some of the other cases, the evidence was thin, and without a confession, he couldn't be convicted. That's an interesting thing about Venona, actually. Because the code-breaking was so secret, the courts couldn't use it as evidence. So whilst they might have had evidence, unless it could be disguised as coming from another source, they couldn't use the Venona evidence. So they knew the guy was a spy, but they couldn't admit it in court. So the guy stayed free. So they knew he was, you know, suspect. So they made him resign from the civil service, and actually made him leave the country. So he took up an academic position in the US. But after Philby defected, Philby defected in 1963, and Anthony Blunt gave his first partial confession in, I think, 1964, Cairncross admitted to MI5 that he had worked for the Soviets. He didn't give the full story. He didn't actually explain that he was the one who basically broke the news of the bomb, but he did say, I did do some work for the Soviets. This was viewed as a sort of a partial cooperation, and he got away without being prosecuted. So again, he slipped from obscurity to obscurity, which suited, I think, as we said earlier, suited everyone quite nicely. Kim Philby, we talked about. He was one of the guy who tipped off some of the spies. Well, he famously defected in 1963, and there's Ben McIntyre's book and TV series that talk about that.
And I have an interview with his granddaughter.
There you go.
As an episode, which is really interesting, because she went to visit him in Moscow. And he was, the family called, well, she used to call him Uncle Kimsky.
There you go. Well, he lived his life, a bit of a sad life in Moscow, but yeah, it's a really good episode, actually. I enjoyed that one. And then Melita Norwood, the last of our spies, well, as I said, she was exposed in 1999. The Home Secretary at the time decided not to prosecute her, prosecute this 87-year-old little old lady. She'd, of course, outlived the entire Soviet Union, so all that she had spied for all those decades had actually ceased to be.
So, I mean, if you look back at the Atom Spies, it was a stunning success. You can't really say anything other than that.
Yep.
And probably the most, I'm trying to think, I mean, to be able to gain the secrets of nuclear weapons is probably not a bigger secret.
No, I think it was world-changing is probably the best way of putting it. Yeah, you're right. You can't deny that Stalin's, I suppose, his foresight of building these networks for nefarious reasons, you know, he's basically out to steal what he could. He needed these secrets to help kickstart his tattered economy. But, you know, he had the foresight to put these guys in place, and then slowly but surely, sometimes despite of themselves, to be honest, we've seen Beria sitting on intelligence because he thought it was disinformation. We've talked about the Cambridge spies, that their prolific output not being believed because it was almost too good to be true, but it was true. So yeah, despite of themselves, they were able to get to this end result. So it gave the Soviet Union the bomb several years ahead. It shifted the balance of power globally. It created the arms race. Because, you know, obviously we haven't mentioned, but, you know, so the Soviets detonated their atomic bomb in 1949. Well, how did Americans then respond? They decide to build the hydrogen bomb. So that then creates another layer of, you know, sort of deadly risk for the world. The Soviets respond by building their hydrogen bomb. The Americans respond by building a bigger bomb, and so on and so on and so on. And that creates the arms race. It also... The success that the Soviets had emboldened them on a sort of geopolitical level as well. So you could argue that without the atomic spies giving them bomb, they would have never have invaded Korea, for example. Those early years of the Cold War, it was the atomic spies, the whole atomic strategy completely drove the early Cold War. It gave the Western intelligence organizations a major wake-up call. I mean, there were loads of wake-up calls they received, these defections that were going through. But obviously, the betrayal of the biggest secret of the Second World War was a real wake-up call. And obviously, they then had to create a whole different intelligence network and so on and so on and so on. But also, I suppose, you know, it gave historians a lot to look at, filmmakers, podcasters, gave us loads of material to talk about. So that's why it's such a fascinating area. And I hope, you know, the listeners enjoy hearing just this little snapshot.
I'm sure they will. And this is just one of the stories in Andrew's book, Secrets of the Cold War, Espionage and Intelligence Operations from Both Sides of the Iron Curtain. It's highly recommended. There'll be links in the episode notes as to where to purchase this. I mean, the book features quite an extensive section on BRICSMIS and the Allied military liaison missions, which I know is a popular subject amongst listeners. So do seek out Andrew's book. It's published by Pen and Sword, Secrets of the Cold War.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter,
You'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.